Welcome to another Salvation by Grace midweek message. Salvation by Grace is the teaching ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. You'll find us on the internet at salvationbygrace.org. We are currently studying the minor prophets of the Old Testament. So grab your Bible and join the congregation of GCA, along with our teaching pastor, Jim McClarty.
We are starting this evening in Hosea 3. Since we began this study in Hosea, I have been putting a lot of emphasis on what I have called the blueprint. You'll be relieved to know that I won't be making any more references to that tonight. We're just going to assume it, because at this point, it kind of lays as the groundwork behind everything we're reading here in Hosea, and so much of what we read in so many of the prophets. But you're also going to hear echoes of it in the New Testament. I don't know why it is that so many in the church world think that in the Old Testament, when God was dealing with Israel, that he was dealing with national Israel. But then when the new covenant came around, any reference to Israel meant the church. And so there is a theology out there that posits that the curses, the bad things that ever happened to Israel, actually happened to the nation of Israel, and they get what they deserve. But any of the positive blessings and promises of restoration that we find in the Old Testament for Israel, those all belong now to the church because of the new covenant. Now, of course, there's nothing in the Bible that says anything like that. If we're going to be serious about what the Bible says, then if we're going to make that large a theological leap, we have to have actual language in the Bible that states that. And that leap is decidedly missing from the Bible anywhere. Tonight, the language is so specific, so exact, that I am convinced that this kind of language is what leads Paul to write the things that he writes about Israel. So at the beginning of the evening, we're going to look at Hosea 3 and then compare it to what Paul wrote to the Romans when defending Israel and God's continuing relationship with them. And that's as much introduction as you need. You know what Hosea says in the first two chapters. You know that Hosea has been told to go and take a wife of whoredoms. They are to have children. The children are named Jezreel, Lo Ruhamah, and Lo Ami, meaning not my people and no mercy. But then God says at the beginning of chapter 3, then Yahweh said to me, go again, love a woman who is loved by her husband and yet an adulteress. And then just so there's no question what God is talking about, he then creates the parallel for us and says, even as the Lord loves the sons of Israel, although they turn to other gods and they love raisin cakes. That reference to raisin cakes is the cakes that were baked to the Queen of Heaven. We read about them in Jeremiah as well. And so they love chasing their other gods, and they love giving sacrifices to their other gods. God calls that akin to adultery, which is why he told Hosea to go marry an adulterous woman. But the parallel here is so obvious. He is told, go again and love a woman who is loved by her husband. Don't miss that, because God is a husband to Israel. And here he is saying to Hosea, go love Gomer again, but do love her. She is your wife. You are going to be a husband to her. And then God himself creates the parallel, even as I love the sons of Israel, even though they're adulterous, even though they are chasing gods. So never forget this basic concept, because Paul is going to pick it up in the book of Romans. that even though Israel has rebelled against God, even though they have chased their other lovers, even though they have worshiped their foreign gods, nevertheless, God is a husband to them, even though he has put them away, he is going to go get them again. And astoundingly, in verse 2, he's not just going to go get them. The language is he's going to redeem them. Look at verse 2. So I, this is first person Hosea talking, so I bought her for myself for 15 shekels of silver and a homer and a half of barley. He went and got his wife back by redeeming her and paying a redemption price. Do I have to spell any of this out? Because again, God is doing all this as an example of his relationship with Israel. He's saying, not only do I love her, although she is adulterous, I will ultimately redeem her. And that's perfectly in keeping with everything we've been seeing for the last few weeks as we have looked at the various passages that are predicting in advance that Israel was going to rebel, that Israel was going to be driven out of their land, that Israel was going to be among the Gentiles. And in that place where God scattered them, that was going to be the place where they were going to turn again and recognize their God, and they were going to return to him. And that story, that basic outline, runs all the way through the Bible. It's unavoidable. But then verse 3 says, then I said to her, you shall stay with me for many days. You shall not play the harlot, nor shall you have a man. So I will also be toward you. In other words, what Hosea has just told her is, you're going to come back with me because I have redeemed you, but there's going to be no intimacy between us. You're going to have to stay alone for a while, and I'm going to be the same way. You are going to still be mine. I love you. I have redeemed you. But in order to stop you from your harlotries and cleanse you, you are going to have a period where there is no direct intimacy between us. Now let's apply that theologically. Does God love Israel? Yes, he says so. But even though he has redeemed her and is in the process of bringing her back to himself, at this very moment, there's no close intimacy between them. Which is why, when you look at them today, you don't see them chasing after idols. You don't see them doing the things that they used to do, chasing Canaanite gods and that kind of stuff. God has taken them away from all that, but at the exact same time, there is no closeness or intimacy between them, but there is the promise that there will be some day when I will be their God and they will be my people, when they build my temple again in Jerusalem, when they reinstitute their worship of me. All of that is coming in the future, and it is all typified by the relationship that Hosea is having with Gomer. I said to her, you shall stay with me for many days. You shall not play the harlot, nor shall you have a man. And so I will also be toward you. And now the explanation, verse 4. This is what that is going to look like. This is the result. For the sons of Israel will remain for many days without a king or a prince, without sacrifice, apparently sacrifice toward God, considering that they don't even have a temple, without sacrifice or sacred pillar. The sacred pillars were used to worship the foreign gods. So not only are they not going to worship Yahweh correctly, but they're also not going to worship their foreign gods. Without an ephod, which is what the high priest used to wear, and it had couches on its shoulders with heavy stones and the names of Israel and Judah on his shoulders, so that when he went into the holiest place to intercede for the people. He was interceding for the particular people. He was atoning for the particular people that he had like a weight on his shoulders. And then covering the linen ephod, there was a gold breastplate that had 12 precious stones and the names of all 12 of the tribes of Israel. It was very specific who the high priest was interceding for each year when he went in to make that atonement. So they're not going to have that. They're not going to have that ephod, but they're also not going to have household idols. I'm going to not have intimacy with you. Though you're mine, I'm going to shut you away, and you're not going to worship your idols, but you're also not going to worship me. There's not going to be that connection that there was between us initially. But then look, verse 5. Afterwards, the sons of Israel will return and seek Yahweh their God and David their king. Okay, remember everything that we've been reading in Zechariah. When is it that they're going to return to God? Well, when Christ comes. And they're going to look on him whom they have pierced, and they're going to weep over him the way that a mother weeps over her only child. Not only are they going to return to God, but they're going to return to God and Christ. They're going to recognize Yahweh their God and David their king, and they will come trembling to the Lord and to his goodness. When? In the last days. Very much like what the blueprint has told us, what Moses told us was going to happen from the very beginning. Now, that is the very short chapter, just 5 verses that make up chapter 3 of Hosea. But that theology is so definite that I think it lays behind what Paul wrote in Romans 9. So turn to Romans 9 for a moment, and then we'll be back to Hosea. I'm talking about Romans 11. So turn to Romans 11. And I am just so tempted to read this entire chapter because Paul is saying here in the New Testament, after the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ, he is saying the same thing that the prophets have been saying. The story hasn't changed at all. The blueprint hasn't changed at all, which is why chapter 11 begins with, I say then, God has not rejected his people, has he? And he's talking about Israel. And his answer is, God forbid, may it never be. For I too am an Israelite, a descendant of Abraham, of the tribe of Benjamin. God has not rejected his people whom he foreknew. Now I got to talk about that word foreknew for just a moment, because far too often when people see that word, they say, well, see, that means that God knows the future and he knows who's gonna do something. He knows who's gonna believe. He knows what choices they're going to make. But the word here in the Greek, prognosko, to know in advance, doesn't mean that he knew things about people. It means he knew those people. Now, granted, he knows everybody on the planet. He's the creator of everybody. But he has a special intimacy, a special relationship with those that he knows in this fashion. It's the same way as in the book of Genesis, where Adam knew Eve and she bore a son. It's that closeness. It's that intimacy. God has not rejected his people who he previously had this intimacy with, did he? Or do you not know what the scripture says in the passage about Elijah, how he pleads with God against Israel and says, Lord, they have killed your prophets. They have torn down your altars. I alone am left, and they are seeking my life. But what is the divine response to him? I have kept to myself 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to Baal. In the same way, then, there has also come to be, at the present time, a remnant according to God's gracious election. So there is a remnant within Israel at the present time, as Paul was writing this, there were those believers who accepted Christ because of God's gracious election. Now hold on to that. We're going to skip further down into the chapter. Let's start reading at verse 25. For I do not want you, brethren, to be ignorant of this mystery. I don't want you to be uninformed where this particular mystery is concerned. The word mysterion there means a previously unrevealed truth. This is something that is going to happen. It's something that God has already intended. It just hasn't come to its fruition yet, and it's not widely known yet. But I don't want you to be ignorant of it. I don't want you to be uninformed of this mystery so that you, he's talking to Gentiles, will not become wise in your own estimation. That a partial hardening has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. Okay, so there's two groups within Israel. The remnant within Israel that has come to faith in their Messiah Christ. That's the remnant. Then there's this other group who have no intimacy currently with God, who are hardened until a particular time, until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in, because God is using salvation to the Gentiles as a way to make Israel jealous. And after the fullness of the Gentiles has come in, verse 26, and so all Israel will be saved, just as it's written. Where is it written? Everything we've been reading for the last several weeks. That ultimately God is going to restore all 12 tribes, northern tribe, southern tribe, bring them back to their land. David's greater son is going to sit on his throne in Jerusalem. They are all going to be gathered together and have one king, and God will be their God. Yahweh will be their God, and they will be his people. That all has to come to its fruition, which is why Paul could say that there is a partial hardening, a lack of intimacy between some parts of Israel and God until a particular time. And so all Israel will be saved because that's what's written down. And then he quotes, the deliverer will come from Zion and will remove ungodliness from Jacob. Who's Jacob?
Israel.
Wrong. It's the church. See, that's where you guys are all messed up. You didn't understand. Jacob, heel catcher, the name for Israel. And the deliverer will come, Christ will come from Zion and will remove ungodliness from Israel. This is my covenant with them when I take away their sins. So is Paul saying anything different than what we've been reading out of the prophets in the Old Testament?
Nope.
No, the story is remarkably consistent, but look at verse 28. This is what I was really wanting to hone in on. From the standpoint of the gospel, the people who say that God is done with Israel, they say it's because they broke his law, they didn't follow the law of Moses, and they rejected their Messiah. Okay, Paul admits that. From the standpoint of the gospel, they are enemies for your sake. Paul has already made this argument about the natural branches and the wild branches. And he said that they were cut off and you were grafted in against nature. But then he goes on and says, but God can graft them back in again. And so now he's arguing that they are enemies for your sake. They were cut off on purpose so that you would be grafted in against nature, so that you Gentiles would be saved in order to make Israel jealous. So then you are the beneficiaries of the fact that they are enemies of the gospel. However, despite the fact that they are not intimate with God, despite the fact that they rejected their Messiah, from the standpoint of God's election, God's choice, remember what we read at the beginning of the chapter? Has he cast off those that he foreknew? No, it's God's election that is guaranteeing their salvation and their ultimate future. From the standpoint of God's choice, they are beloved for the sake of the fathers. It's exactly what we just read out of Hosea. God just said, go get that woman of harlotry because you're a husband who loves her. And here Paul picks that language up and says, yes, Israel is an enemy of the gospel, but is touching the promises that God has made through their forefathers, and because of his electing grace, he nevertheless loves them, though they are indeed enemies of the gospel. Verse 29, because the gifts and the calling of God are irrevocable. They are beloved for the sake of the fathers, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, the Abrahamic covenant. So they are still awaiting that covenant's full fruition. It is an unconditional covenant, and God is going to perform that entire covenant for them because he still loves them, just like Hosea has said. And from the standpoint of God's choice, they are still beloved for the sake of the fathers because God doesn't change. And the gifts of God and the calling of God, all of which belong to Israel. Remember, every covenant in the Bible, everyone without exception, belongs to Israel. Even the new covenant states in Jeremiah 31 and in Hebrews 8 that it's a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. Not like the covenant that I made with them when I took them by the hand, took them out of the land of Egypt, which covenant they broke. Hence, new covenant. And so if God has faithfully called these people, has given these gifts, these promises, these covenants to these people, that's irrevocable. God doesn't change. And as I have said so many times through the years, you don't want a God that can change. If God could change his mind about Israel, especially with everything we've been reading, Old and New Testament, if he could change his mind, he could change his mind about you. You have no security. You have no confidence. But he's a God who does not change. Therefore, the people that he chose before the foundation of the world, despite their failures and their sins and their rebellions, nevertheless are going to wind up saved because the gifts and the calling of God are irrevocable. And that also means, within this context, that God is indeed going to do everything that he promised through the prophets. He's going to redeem Israel. He's going to regather Israel. He's going to put them back in their land because those gifts, those promises, are irrevocable too. And even though they are currently enemies of the gospel, from the standpoint of God's choice and election, they're beloved because of the promises he made to the fathers. You got it?
Got it.
For just as you once were disobedient to God, but now have been shown mercy because of their disobedience, so there's actually a plan at work here. Their disobedience came about so that Gentiles would be saved. Just like Paul said previously in this same chapter, that the salvation of the Gentiles was to make Israel jealous, and that they were cut off from their natural tree, from their natural root, so that you could be grafted in. There is a plan at work here. For just as you too were once disobedient to God, but now have been shown mercy because of their disobedience, so these also now, these disobedient ones of Israel, these too have been disobedient, that because of the mercy shown to you, they also may now be shown mercy. In other words, what's God's intention for them? Mercy. What was Hosea's child name? No Mercy. But they're going to get mercy because Hosea was also told, and in the place that they are called, not my people, and no mercy, I will have mercy on them and they will be my people. Paul picks up that language here and says, you've been shown mercy, and then they are going to be shown mercy. Why? Because God, in his great sovereign plan, has shut up everybody into disobedience so that he can show mercy to all. That way he gets all the glory. Nobody deserves it. But everybody who is saved, Jew and Gentile, will ultimately celebrate the goodness and the grace of God, and no one can say that they did it. It's all about God's mercy and his glorification of himself, which is why Paul can then say the depths of the riches, both of the wisdom and the knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgments? How unfathomable are his ways? I argue that the folks who are saying, God's done with Israel. You know, they've broken his law and they rejected their Messiah, and therefore God is done with them utterly and completely. They're actually trying to make the wisdom of God more understandable, more fathomable, because God being judgmental to the people who broke his law, we can comprehend that. We're the same way. But if he is continuing to love and make promises to this people group who has continually rejected his law and his Messiah, and he's doing that on purpose so that the Gentiles can be saved, who could have come up with that? And then to say in advance, that's what I'm going to do, and then wouldn't you know that that's the way it worked out in human history? That's kind of on the unfathomable side. How unsearchable are his judgments? And unfathomable his ways. For who has known the mind of the Lord, or whoever became his counselor? Or who has first given to him that it might be paid back to him again? Which is the way so much of Christianity is preached. You know, that whole God knows what people are going to do. He knows who's going to choose him. So then he chooses them back in response to the fact that they choose. Well, then that means that they first gave something to God, and then he was obligated to give something back to them. Paul says that never happened. Who was ever first given something to God so that it would be paid back to him again? For from him and through him and to him are all things, and to him is the glory forever. I am convinced that Paul got that theology from passages just like we're reading in Hosea. Turn back to Hosea. Let's read chapter 3 again and see if you don't see Paul's language in Hosea's language, or vice versa. The Lord said to me, go again, love a woman who is loved by her husband. So his representation of Israel is, she's a harlot, and I love her, and I will get her back. How is he going to get her back? By redeeming her. She is yet an adulteress, even as the Lord loves the sons of Israel, although they turn to other gods, and they love the cakes to the queen of heaven. So I bought her for myself for 15 shekels of silver and a homer and a half of barley. And then I said to her, you shall stay with me for many days. You shall not play the harlot, but nor shall you have me. You're not going to have any man, and so I will also be toward you. For the sons of Israel will remain for many days without king or prince. That's happening right now. Without sacrifice or sacred pillar, in other words, not worshiping me or worshiping their foreign gods, without an ephod and without their household idols. But afterwards, the sons of Israel will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king, and they will come trembling to the Lord and to his goodness in the last days when he does finally show them the mercy, the way Paul put it, and so all Israel will be saved. To me, that's kind of on the black and white side. I don't know how you read that or understand it any differently than God is faithful to his promises. God is going to do what he said he's going to do, because that's the kind of God you want, a faithful God who is faithful to Israel and to you, to the Jew first and also to the Gentile. chapter 4. Let's see how far we get here. Now God is going to lay out his case. We've seen this repeatedly in several of the prophets, where God just needs to lay out his case before Israel and say, you are in fact guilty. That's why I'm treating you this way. Listen to the word of the Lord, O sons of Israel. For the Lord has a case against the inhabitants of the land. Because there is no faithfulness and there is no kindness in the land. Now that's really interesting to me because in Luke 18:8, Jesus says, when I return, will I find faith in the land? That wasn't something new that Jesus was talking about. Back here in Hosea, it is already said that in the land, in that particular bit of soil, which is the actual Ge language here, G-E, from which we get like geography, the land, the actual soil is referred to as the Ge, the land. So he's talking about the land of Israel, especially because he says, I have a case against the inhabitants of the land. So that's the land of Israel that he's going to be driving them out of. And he says, and there is no faithfulness or kindness in the land. And then Jesus comes to the planet and says, still none. When I come back, will there be any? Very consistent condemnation of the land of Israel. There is no knowledge of God in the land. But there is swearing and deception and murder and stealing and adultery. They employ violence so that bloodshed follows bloodshed. Then verse 3 describes God's reaction that he's going to bring drought to them. Therefore the land mourns. That's why you're going through the trouble you're going through. That's why I'm bringing these droughts on you, just like I told you when I made my covenant with you at Mount Sinai, that if you didn't follow my law, I would bring these droughts on you. I would withhold the rain so that you would be hungry. And now the land mourns, and everyone who lives in it languishes, along with the beasts of the field and the birds of the sky, and also the fish of the sea disappear. Because God is drying up the rivers and the lakes and the water. And then he turns his attention to the priests in Israel. The priests have a particular responsibility. The priests are supposed to be interceding for the people to God, but then also holding the people accountable. They were supposed to be teaching the law of God. This is the expectation of God, and they weren't doing it. So in verse 4, we start reading, yet let no one find fault, let no one offer reproof. In a minute, God's going to say, they're so far gone, just let them be. I'm just going to bring my punishment, and there's no talking to them anymore. For your people are like those who argue with the priest. In other words, the priest tells them, follow the law, bring your sacrifices, come be reconciled to God. And they don't even listen, and they go their own way because the land is full of deception and swearing and murder and stealing and adultery and violence and bloodshed. So they won't listen to the priests. Your people are like those who contend with the priests. So you priests, so you will stumble by day, and the prophet also will stumble with you by night. And I will, this is really interesting poetic language here, and I will destroy your mother. That word destroy there is not completely do away with, it's cut off. It's to separate her, to send her away out of her land. For my people are destroyed, same word, cut off, for lack of knowledge. A moment ago, we read Paul saying, God's wisdom and knowledge is beyond comprehension. At least Paul was attempting to approach the knowledge of God. God's accusation against Israel here is they've cut themselves off from knowledge. They don't want to know from me. They want to know the revelation that the prophets are bringing to them. They don't want to know how to sacrifice, how to worship to me. And so I will cut off your mother, and my people are cut off for their lack of knowledge. Because you have rejected, the Hebrew word there again is despised knowledge. You've rejected it. You've held it away from you. So I will despise you, exact same word. I will despise you and reject you from being my priests because you haven't treated my people correctly. You haven't taught them accurately. You haven't given them my knowledge. Therefore, you all collectively have cast me away, so I'm going to cast you away. You've despised my knowledge. Therefore, I despise you from being a priest anymore. Since you have forgotten the law of your God, I also will forget your children. So he's telling the priest, you're guilty, and what you have done to me, I'm doing to you. Cutting you off, despising you, forgetting you. The more they multiplied, still talking about the priests, the more they multiplied, the more they sinned against me. So I will change their glory into shame. They feed on the sin of my people. And they direct their desire toward the people's iniquity. And it will be the way I punish the people, I will also punish the priests. It will be like people, like priest. So I will punish them for their ways and repay them for their deeds. And they will eat, but not have enough. They will play the harlot, but not increase. Because they have stopped giving heed to Yahweh. Harlotry, wine, and new wine take away the understanding. My people consult their wooden idols, and their diviners' wands inform them. So they're into witchcraft, and they're into magic, and they're into foreign gods, but they don't consult me, for a spirit of harlotry has led them astray. And they have played the harlot, departing from their God. They offer sacrifices on the tops of the mountains, and they burn incense on the hills, under the oak, the poplar, the terebinth, because their shade is pleasant. And therefore your daughters play the harlot, and your brides commit adultery. But then this is, again, the amazing wisdom of God. He ends up saying in verse 14, you know, this is on your daughters and this is on your brides, but I'm not going to punish them because ultimately it's you men who have led the way and you led them astray. So God knows who is guilty, how guilty they are, what damage they're doing, and who has just been simply led astray in their ignorance. I will not punish your daughters when they play the harlot or your brides when they commit adultery. For the men themselves go apart with harlots and offer sacrifices with temple prostitutes. So the people as a whole, all of them, are without understanding and they are ruined. Though you, Israel, play the harlot, do not let Judah become guilty. So now this prophecy is beyond just the northern tribes, but the southern tribes are watching it happen. At the time, there is still a temple in Jerusalem. There is still the worship of Yahweh going on in Jerusalem. But the northern tribes, who have been separated ever since God took the kingdom away from the son of Solomon, they have gone off into their idolatry and their harlotry. And so God is warning Judah and saying, even though you see this happening among your brethren, don't you follow the way that they're leading. Although you, Israel, play the harlot, don't let Judah become guilty. Also, do not go to Gilgal. That was the main place where the temples were among the northern tribes, a primary place of worship. So don't leave Judah to go up there and worship up there. And don't go up to Beth Aven, which means the house of wickedness. By the way, that particular place used to have the name Bethel, the house of God. It's the very place where Jacob laid his head down and had his dream of Jacob's ladder and the angels of heaven ascending and descending. And because of the depth of their harlotries in the land, God changed the name from the house of God to the house of wickedness. And don't take oaths. Don't be saying, as the Lord lives. In other words, don't come down here to my temple and take oaths to me, make promises to me, worship me, and then go up to Gilgal, go up to Beth-Aven, go up and worship with them and worship their idols. God is very, very clear, considering that the very first commandment is, you'll have no other gods before me. He is a jealous God. He wants to make sure that his people are completely devoted to him and him alone. And therefore, he can say to Judah, don't go up there and worship gods and then come down here and start making vows and promises by my name and saying, as Yahweh lives, I'll do these things. That is the very demonstration of hypocrisy. Then he likens Israel to a stubborn old cow. Since Israel is stubborn, like a stubborn heifer, can the Lord now pasture them like a lamb in a large field? Okay, a lamb in a large field, especially if there's only one, in a large field of grass, that lamb is having a great day. He's well taken care of, and he's in a large field. But he's saying, they are not my lambs. They're not my sheep. They're like stubborn old cows. And if that's the way they're being with me, how do I then treat them like tender lambs? I can't. Since Israel is stubborn like a stubborn heifer, can the Lord now pasture them like a lamb in a large field? Ephraim has joined to idols, so let him alone. That's why at the beginning of the chapter, he said in verse 4, let no one find fault and let no one offer reproof, for your people are like those who contend with a priest. He's just saying they are the way they are. I'm going to punish them, but leave them alone. Stay away from them. Judah, don't go join yourself to them. Ephraim has joined to idols. Let him be. Their liquor is gone, which means they're a bunch of drunks. They've drunk everything they have. They play the harlot continually. They're drunken harlots. And their rulers dearly love shame. The wind wraps them in its wings, which is an indication that they're about to be utterly dispersed and blown away. And they will be ashamed because of their sacrifices. Okay, so now why did God go through the trouble of what we read in chapter 4 after what we've read in chapter 3? After all these promises of, I love you and I will restore you, and you will come seeking the Lord your God and David your king, and you will come trembling to the Lord and to his goodness in the last days. And then he follows that up with, you're nothing but evil all the time. Why did God lay it out that way? I think it's because he's trying to demonstrate that his grace is more astounding than we can begin to understand. First, he says, I've loved you with an everlasting love. Like Jeremiah 31:3, therefore, with loving kindness have I drawn you to myself. Okay, that's true. God loves Israel. And oh yeah, Israel is utterly unlovable. And they're doing everything they can to reject God, to despise his wisdom, to hate his precepts, to argue with his priests because they love their murders and their adulteries. They love the depravity that they've brought to their land. And nevertheless, God's intention for them is that he is going to be their God and that they are going to be his people. That's astounding. Can you see now why Paul would read stuff like that and then write what he wrote in Romans 11? And then sum it up as, who can figure this out? The wisdom of God is beyond finding out. It's unfathomable. If it was us, or if it was just basic logic, if it was more fathomable, then God would say, okay, you've rejected me, so forget you. To hell with the lot of you. But to find out that he is going to forgive people who are that depraved, who are that sinful, who have rejected him, who are currently living in a state where they have no intimacy with him, and they are rejecting their Messiah, to know that that is their state and that he still ever loves them and is going to keep all the promises he ever made to them for his own great glory, that ought to make all of us have a great deal of confidence, because I'm telling you, there's nothing Israel's guilty of that we're not. We've also had our rebellions and rejections, and we have all shaken our fist at God. And yet, he loved us through it. Because if it weren't for his love, if it weren't for his grace, if it weren't for his mercy, nobody gets saved. But because he made a determination before the foundation of the world that there were going to be people that were going to redound to the glory of his Son, so that every knee will bow and every tongue confess, and that Jesus gets all the glory forever, because that's his master plan, which he laid out all the way back in Deuteronomy. This is the blueprint. This is how it's going to go. This is my plan. He told us in advance what he was going to do, and right now he's in the middle of doing it. And that makes sense of the whole Bible. And all of that language of God rejecting Israel is dangerous language, certainly not biblical language, because if God can do that, you're hopeless. But thank God that he's like he describes himself in the Bible. And when he makes a promise to people, he keeps it, and that means he's keeping you.
Amen.
Every single head in the room just nodded in unison. And it was like listening to maracas being played. That was a nice moment. So.
Thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace midweek message. We encourage you to visit our website at salvationbygrace.org for books, articles, and our ever-expanding archive of audio sermons. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.